At the Brandywine Creek in 1777, one of the British Army's best marksmen, a man who had invented a special kind of rifle for snipers, may have had a clear shot at George Washington. Taking the shot would have been easy, but per 18th century ethics, also disgusting. He didn't take the shot, and history remained unchanged, perhaps. There's a couple of issues with the encounter between the Scottish marksman Patrick Ferguson and George Washington before the Battle of Brandywine, an American loss in the Revolutionary War. Ferguson was never sure it was George Washington. All he described was seeing a senior American official with a cocked hat, accompanied by a French hussar. It's not clear if Ferguson would have known what Washington looked like. Pictures were not published in newspapers then. He suspected it was Washington because he heard reports that Washington was indeed around the area that day from American prisoners that were captured by the British. But no one could confirm that he was with a hussar. The French were not yet involved in the land fight, siding with the Americans at this time. It's also possible that this senior American official could have been Count Pulaski, a Polish nobleman who was known to don a hussar suit, as he had been living in France at the time he left for America to join the revolutionary fight. In fact, it could have been both Pulaski and Washington. Pulaski could have been the hussar described by Ferguson. We'll never know, but regardless, Patrick Ferguson thought it disgusting to fire upon someone who has not attacked us, who appeared to be merely discharging his duties and giving orders. It was a different time for the rules of war. Would Ferguson have changed history, killing George Washington at Brandywine? Well, possibly, or possibly not. Depends what aspect of history we're talking about. The dreaded counterfactual. We know Washington led the American army to victory, but it certainly wasn't immediate. He had already pulled off his game-changing victory of the Revolutionary War, his most brilliant tactical move, the Battle of Trenton. That was already done at the time of Brandywine. America was not without other good generals. Horatio Gates, Benedict Arnold, prior to his turning traitor. Those two would win the Battle of Saratoga against a large British army. Nathanael Greene would show promise in the Southern campaigns and act as Washington's right hand. And although he would only prove his mettle in the Battle of Brandywine, attacking while others were retreating, there was also the Marquis de Lafayette, the Frenchman that would capture the hearts of Americans and the Continental Congress so successful that he would run the defense of Virginia and inspire France to help the United States. He was even suggested as a commander, replacing Washington at one point by some members of the Continental Congress. Lafayette, of course, refused. But there were other generals. Victory in the Revolutionary War was a hard road, and it required many failed efforts, stalemates, required us to, after the Brandywine, to watch the capture of the ostensible capital of the Americas at the time, Philadelphia, where the Declaration was signed. The seizure of a capital may have crippled other nations. The commercial capital of New York, also in British hands. For Washington's death would have been of limited change to the Revolution, in my opinion. But big change for the lack of a first president of the kind of character of Washington to be able to lead the nation with the kind of authority, status, and justice. The Ferguson-Washington encounter didn't lead to Washington's death. Ferguson was the one that would be killed in the Battle of Kings Mountain a few years after Brandywine. But the issues raised by the Scottish marksman and his decision not to shoot and the differing attitudes of history versus today still influence our politics. In April, a Predator drone carrying a Hellfire missile flew over the house of the father-in-law of Betula Masood in Waziristan, Pakistan. Masood was known as the leader of the Taliban in Pakistan. Foolishly, perhaps, he was on the rooftop with his father-in-law, his wife, and a medic. He suffered from a kidney ailment and was receiving an IV drip. Two Hellfire missiles were released, and Massoud was incinerated, along with the relatives and many of his bodyguards. Massoud was no sympathetic or lovable target, not the kind of good officer doing his duty that the old Scott sniper would have spared. He was responsible for hundreds of terrorist incidents, including, possibly, the killing of Benazir Bhutto, candidate for president of Pakistan, and undermining the Pakistani government. His assassination was attempted several times previously. This time, when the Pakistani foreign minister reviewed the tapes of the killing, he said it was perfect. Like a James Bond movie. Yet, it was no movie. It was all stunningly real. Is this what warfare is now? We send over a machine, piloted by a man who might be in a uniform or might not be in a uniform, thousands of miles away, and kill the leader of our opponents. With a terrible monster, it seems like that's just what we do. When the host country is elated that we do it, it seems right. When they approve, and sometimes approve targets, it seems right. But it seems so different from how warfare has always been understood. Or is it? Not all that far from where many of these Predator drones are flown out of. And nearly 200 years ago, an American sniper hid in a tree. He fired his rifle and killed the man he knew at least was a senior officer, who turned out to be General Robert Ross. He knew it by the hat he was wearing. We do not know whether this particular marksman received specific instructions to target Ross. But snipers either were instructed to stay away from shooting officers or not. And clearly, his instructions were the latter. In any case, no one on the American side shed a tear. Ross was a ruthless and brave commander who had just scattered the American militia at Blandesburg, Maryland, destroying the state's defenses, and he was heading towards his target of Baltimore, Maryland. Except that on the way, after his advance, troops were fired on while he was attempting to take the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. His own horse was fired on. In retaliation, he ordered Washington, D.C. razed. The killing of Ross was not regretted much, except perhaps by the sniper, who was killed moments later. It was a decisive act that meant that the British land attack was deprived of a great leader, a psychological disadvantage to the British men, and it added to the increased resistance by fresher American militia units who stalled the British advance. Without Ross, there was no significant land attack. Without a significant land attack, Baltimore could be defended by the sea. A great defense was mounted. Despite terrible cannon fire, Baltimore was saved. Sniping in that case, taking out a leader, had proved remarkably effective. Ross's replacement was half the leader that he was. Predator snipers, in a similar fashion, have been credited at least with keeping Al-Qaeda on the run in Pakistan and Afghanistan. As CIA Chief Leon Panetta said, it's the only game in town. The Obama administration has shown a proclivity towards drone usage, or at least no reluctance. A Predator attack occurred on the third day of Barack Obama's presidency, and at least unofficial reports say that the attacks have increased from the Bush administration. The nature of the attacks, ordered above from the sky and targeting known terrorists without, hopefully, unnecessary casualties, has possibly proven attractive to the new administration. They are less popular in the Arab world. Drone attacks from the sky are a PR nightmare for the United States. The recent Times Square bombing suspect indicated that drone attacks are part of the reason why he committed the crime. In July 2001, when Israel used a Predator drone to attack Palestinian terror suspects, we, the United States, condemned the attack. But 9/11 changed our perspective. We faced an enemy that was hiding, that we couldn't find in an area we don't know much about, that we don't have good maps, and we have poor human intelligence. The drone seems like a solution. The U.S. Air Force went from 40 predators in 2001 to over 200 today. And that's the published results. The CIA does not care to publish its numbers for podcasters to give to the world. The idea of using unmanned planes is as old as the invention and subsequent military use of the airplane. Unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, the proper term for what we have been experimenting with since the use of radio control techniques in the early 20th century. In the Vietnam War, UAV earned its incorrect name that we now use. UAVs were sent to gather information on enemy positions. A camera on the plane could record video onto a tape. The tapes were then put to film and viewed by commanders. The units were slower than the ones today. They had no autonomous control and very little control at all. They could fly in a pattern, and when they ran out of fuel, they landed. Thus, to these dumb planes, the term drone was applied. And that name is stuck. It is no longer appropriate to the type of equipment we have today. But just as we shouldn't use the term podcast, when you could very well be listening to me on your computer or on a Zoom player for that matter, we still do. Terms stick. These UAVs come in a variety of shapes and sizes. Most are made in the U.S. by Northrop Grumman or General Atomics. Some are made in Israel, some are made in Europe. UAVs can fly for long periods with no worry about operator fatigue. They carry cameras of all sorts of types. They can also carry detectors for chemical weapons. They can carry food, water, medical supply kits. They can search for enemies, or they can stare at a battlefield for long periods without fatigue to relay events to command. There's no delay between taking a tape and putting it onto film and showing it to the commanders. It's instant. Just like we can see a football game with so many angles, the generals can now get a better image of what's going on in the battlefield. And this one is reminded of the balloons used in the Napoleonic Wars, or used by General George McClellan during the Peninsula Campaign in the Civil War to try to get a sense of the size of enemy units. It didn't always work. He certainly exaggerated what the information he saw. He certainly exaggerated the numbers of troops. Or the early airplanes used in World War I, which were critical in a muddy, foggy, heads-down battlefield to determine where there might be a gap in the trenches to exploit. These early efforts were rarely decisive, but UAVs are better spies. They can look at a battlefield and see where shots or IEDs come from, even if the shooters are hiding. These activities of the drones do not create any controversy. It is where the drones take the next step and deliver a missile where they're seen in a different light, particularly where the battlefield is not a battlefield at all, but a civilian space. In a war, that doesn't always occur in a battlefield where our enemy leaders are not always wearing uniforms. But perhaps all that has changed is our ability to do it, and not so much the decision to target leaders. During World War II, over the Pacific Ocean, Admiral Yamamoto decided to make a morale-boosting trip to the front to see his Japanese troops fighting the Americans in the Pacific. Despite urging from local commanders that it was dangerous, he took off in a Mitsubishi G4M fast transport plane. Unbeknownst to anyone in the Japanese military, U.S. intelligence had de-encrypted the magic code that the Japanese used. And they knew he was flying. The order from the president was instant and clear. Yamamoto was a successful admiral and an enemy of the United States. Get Yamamoto, FDR told Navy Secretary Frank Knox. P-38 Lightnings, the fastest and long-range aircraft in the U.S. arsenal, were dispatched. After engaging some enemy Zeros, Lieutenant Rex T. Barber, on one of the P-38s, sprayed the transport that Yamamoto was in with gunfire. There were two transports. He was not sure whether he had hit the vehicle that Yamamoto was in or the other. But he had. Yamamoto would be killed by the bullets prior prior to the plane crashing in the jungle. For the Japanese, it was a huge psychological blow. Their public had been led to believe that the Japanese were winning the war. They were not told about some of the more challenging battles. They were told the U.S. military was declining, and they had no idea how we did it. How a military that was supposedly on the decline took out Admiral Matt Yamamoto. We did not reveal, obviously, our code-breaking ability. But the example informs U.S. policy. Taking out an enemy leader, as foreign as it might have seemed to an 18th century marksman, is a no-brainer in war. We tried to kill Gaddafi in 1986. We sent Tomahawk missiles to kill bin Laden in 1998. In 2002, Paul Wolfowitz gleefully announced that a Predator killed one of the bombers of the U.S. Cole. According to at least one aide to the Joint Chiefs, the Predator drones are successful because Al-Qaeda is on its heels, fearing assassination by drone. The policy of killing leaders has not changed, merely the technology. Yet, for UN lawyer Philip Aston, special counsel to the Committee on Extrajudicial Assassinations at the UN, the drone program is troubling. He has asked repeatedly about the program in 2004 and in 2008. They blew me off, he said. He's getting no further information from the Obama administration than he did from the Bush administration. Aston is concerned and says that drones create an accountability void. The ACLU has also sought information about the civilian program as well, has obtained very little. The UN and the ACLU are not the only questioners of a program that features attacks from the sky. The Christian Century alleged that drone wars violate the just war principle. In a just war, one must consider that it's better to risk the lives of one's own combatants, their soldiers, than non-combatants who live in enemy territories. By that standard, it's questionable whether a drone program works. There's little risk to the attacker. You're not risking your own soldiers. All the risk is to, of course, the enemy who you're targeting, but also the enemy's non-combatants. Even with a drone attack, as precise as they are, a Hellfire missile can cause damage to others and there could be civilian deaths. There likely have been many civilian deaths, although it's very difficult to calculate how many. Jesuit America called the program a troubling disconnection between attacker and attacked. Notre Dame professor Eileen O'Donnell said that battlefield drones are lawful only on the battlefield and not lawful outside of the combat zone, not lawful in law enforcement operations. NYU Law School human rights law professor Hina Shamsi said the Predator program is targeting killing by the state and raises the question as to whether or not it might be used someday domestically. Gary Simpson, a theology professor at Luther Seminary at St. Paul, said that drones raise questions about proportionality in war. Normally, the benefits of war must be proportionate to the expected harm in any decision to go to war. Drones turn this upside down. Drones make it easy. Will we fear less declaring war or entering war more often now, because of the ease of war with drones as opposed to sending the boys in harm's way? It can be said that in the bulk of American history, we, the United States, declared war reluctantly. We had no standing army to begin with. In fact, even in our first real declared war, when the War Hawks in Congress pushed James Madison to declare war with England in 1812, we still fought that war with militia. That was 30 years as a nation. And during that time, we dodged wars with France, 1798, and with England in 1807 to 1808, instead opting for an embargo. We did conduct the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War. We did not, as other nations have, send our military all over the world that frequently. Most notably, the nation entered the already progressing wars in Europe during World War I and World War II very reluctantly. Wilson did what he could to keep the nation out of war, trying to negotiate peace, eventually condemning submarine attacks on all sides, eventually sending supplies to help the Allies and loaning the money. The U.S. people were not fans of European war. A note from the Speaker of the House, Champ Clark, to Woodrow Wilson said, "We can't be thinking of sending our boys to Europe." Franklin Roosevelt faced opposition to supporting the Allies as well in the run-up to World War II. Both Wilson and Roosevelt sought half measures. Wilson sold supplies to the Allies. FDR had his lend-lease program. But what if these leaders had a third option? Just having the intelligence service of the United States covertly targeting enemy leaders, as opposed to having to choose between sending troops or not. War is already vague these days. We have a war on terrorism which exists in all sorts of forms, which blends law enforcement and war, which sometimes occurs on what could be described as battlefields and traditional type fights, but also occurs in cities which are not considered battlefields. Will drones make wars more vague? Will we have wars at all, per se? The CIA drones already operate in Afghanistan, where there is a war zone, but also in Pakistan, which is not a war zone. The CIA drone operators in Langley, Virginia, are unclassified. They don't experience the fatigue of war, the shock, maybe some of the shock, but not the absolute on-the-spot shock, and certainly not the harm faced by a normal attacker in a war. When they're finished, they drive home to their families and eat supper. Have we created, as at least one UN official called it, PlayStation war? A war with no costs. And will that make it easier to declare war in the future, where in American history, war declaring has always been hard? It's not the only question raised by drones. With scores of nations with some kind of UAV technology, the idea of a complete drone war, where we send out our drones, the enemy sends out theirs, and they fight it out, has been raised. We should not think that forever the United States would be the only nation with this type of technology in great numbers. Eventually, drones could target the United States. We know that every technological weapon, battleships, tanks, repeating rifles, airplanes, and finally nuclear weapons, got into multiple hands. Multiple militaries possessed them soon after their invention, more than just the enemy that created them. England was the first to use tanks in World War I and used them very successfully, but they were difficult to produce in large numbers and overall were not decisive in that war. Germany looked at those lessons, profited from them, and created a tank force rival to none. While we were the first to develop a nuclear bomb, it took the Soviet Union roughly 5 years to get our technology and develop their own. Yet, and this is important to the concept of a drone war, we never ended up having what was thought of perhaps in 1948, certainly in 1962, or even in the 1980s, a complete missile war. Us firing our missiles, the Soviet Union firing theirs, a nuclear war with no conventional troops. 65 years after Hiroshima, we still send our young boys, our tanks, in harm's way in Afghanistan for a military objective. Despite science fiction images that might be in our heads now, it's possible that drones would not completely replace human fighters in the future as well. And then at some point, no matter how big one's drone army is, human fighters will have to enter the equation. We looked at the question of, are drones moral? That's one question. Do they work? That is another. According to many experts, they are working. They may be the only thing working in the war on terror, only game in town, as Leon Panetta said. Former Joint Chief of Staff expert Dennis Blair said, "The drone attacks have put the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda in a very precarious state, where they can never depend on reliable leadership." A New York Times reporter, David Rhodes, who was captured by the Taliban, expressed how nervous his captors were of any day being assassinated by a drone from the sky. Daniel Byman, director of the Georgetown Center for Peace and Security, disagrees. "Dead men tell no tales. terrorist killed and not captured cannot provide intelligence information. But according to Haider Ali Hussein Mulek, a counterinsurgency analyst at U.S. Joint Special Operations University, most of the drone targets would be of limited value anyway and could not be captured. These are not guys you can talk to, he said. John McCreary, a former strategic analyst for the Joint Chiefs, said, killing leaders supports an illusion of progress, but not the reality. Those who take over from the assassinated leaders may be under more pressure within the organization to prove their worth by staging spectacular stunts or daring attacks. It's certainly something to think about, and history may be of some use in this question. Does targeting leaders even work? There was an adage that Colin Powell was saying to George H.W. Bush in talking about regime change. There isn't some Thomas Jefferson waiting in the desert to take over after Saddam Hussein would be replaced. And it's possibly true. Maybe the next guy who takes over isn't an improvement over the last. But do you have to look at it that way? Can we demoralize leadership with the drone attacks, keep forcing them to keep changing leadership? History is very useful. I mean, probably the most dramatic example, which I indicated, is George Washington almost being shot by a sniper at Brandywine. I feel, and probably this could be disputed or argued with, that at least in terms of the Revolutionary War, with all the other forces operating and the significant victories occurring that Washington was not leading elsewhere in other theaters, and with the French intervention, that we were probably going to win the Revolutionary War effort in about the time that we did, which is a long struggle, especially considering it was after Washington's Trenton master stroke. So perhaps in that situation, changing leadership might not have changed the outcome of the war. But we killed Ross. That changed the outcome of the war. We killed Yamamoto. That likely led to a tremendous disadvantage in terms of Japanese military leadership. On the other hand, replacing leadership doesn't always work. And although they weren't targeted by assassins, we have to remember that the two great generals of the Civil War on the Union and the Confederate side, Lee and Grant, were not the ones who started the war as commanders-in-chief of their armies. They both came in as a result of being replacements. World War II provides an example of decisions made in the past by leaders. Operation Foxley was a scheme by British Secret Service for an operation to kill Adolf Hitler. There was a variety of plans, having his tea poisoned, having his uniform doused with bacteria, blowing his train up, or shooting him while he took a short walk. Churchill approved and knew of the operation, as documents released in 1998 revealed. It was necessary, according to one official in the British intelligence, because Hitler had a mystical hold over the German people that would keep the Allies from ever picking apart Germany as they invaded and conquered, or inspiring other factions in Germany to rise up against him. A lesser leader they could do that with. Another British colonel who knew of the operation thought it was ridiculous. Killing the Führer, he insisted, would canonize Hitler. It would give birth, too, to the myth that Germany would have won the war if Hitler wasn't assassinated by this covert operation, which might inspire resistance in the future. They never really needed to conduct those debates because there was no successful British Secret Service operation, and we don't know even how close they ever got. The attempt on Hitler came only from a member of his own officer corps. But these debates are still part of the questions raised by the predator attacks, by targeting leaders. Drone attacks are seen as precise by the military, and probably the most precise, more than human bombs. But they, of course, can cause some casualties and outrage, perhaps canonizing the people who are targets as well, making martyrs out of them. They were great warriors, but killed from something from the sky, which they had no chance of defending. And I'd like to add another dimension. We should not think that all of these debates and discussions are occurring in some considered fashion by one person. I can debate these issues with no pressures on me, no whispers in my ear, no sense of responsibility for making decision with limited information. We don't know what the influences are on President Obama, for instance, in making decision to use less or more of these drone attacks. Union troops captured Atlanta in the fall of 1864. It's a huge public relations victory for the Union. It helped Lincoln to be reelected and to set the Confederacy on the path to defeat. But in effect, a key rail link and a key industrial center for the South was destroyed. It hadn't destroyed the Confederacy. Sherman proposed an audacious plan to build on his victory in Atlanta. He would march to Savannah. He would march to the sea, through Georgia, directly through enemy territory, and as he said, make Georgia howl. Along the way, he would not only try to find the enemy army, he would burn anything related to the sale of cotton, which for cotton sales were being used to buy arms for Confederates, so barns and storage bins. He would send foragers out to find any food they could from Confederate farms in order to feed his army, to take all of the crops and food from the land. Any slaves that they met along the way would be informed of their freedom. He wasn't out to kill the population, but his so-called hard war would break their spirit. He awaited the approval of his plan. Now, there is no way that Abraham Lincoln would have come up with his own plan to make Georgia howl. Lincoln was a more moderate leader than that. It's unlikely even that the commander of U.S. forces, Ulysses S. Grant, would have come up with that type of a plan to bring the war to the civilian population. But Grant trusted Sherman. Sherman was audacious. He had done everything that Grant wanted. Grant came up with strategy. Sherman implemented it. And Lincoln trusted Grant. He had been the only general that he could rely on for wins. Thus, not so much the merits of any particular plan, but the circle of trust that existed, that saw the plan approved, and Sherman marched to the sea. Immediately, Atlanta was set on fire. About 30% of the buildings were destroyed, and Sherman's so-called little devils, teenage Union troops, marched to Savannah. Similarly, who knows what kind of dynamics are going on in today's military decisions between the president, his defense team, the Joint Chiefs, others in the Pentagon, the CIA, the influence of the former Bush administration and decisions they made, commitments to foreign leaders, commitments to Pakistan. We should not think that it's simple decisions and reached on only by a president reading a memo. I don't often discuss military topics on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast. It does seem that the drone wars creates a situation where politics and military mix. All we can do at this point is raise the question, but it's something that I think many will have their eyes on as we proceed into the future and drones are used in this fashion, with a weapon that is either keeping the enemy on the run or making us a little less of a reputable nation in the world. I want to thank you for listening. The website's myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Reminder about the Facebook site. You can go and comment. Reminder about the archive, 1499, hours and hours and hours of podcasts and a variety of political and historical topics. Thanks for listening.